This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You know that feeling when you envy a friend because they're more successful than you, or you think they have a better life than you do, and that jealousy hits you in an almost physical way, even though you know better? That kind of envy is what the new film Brad's Status is about. It was written and directed by my guest Mike White, who also created the HBO series Enlightened, wrote the films School of Rock, Nacho Libre, and Beatrice at Dinner, and wrote and directed Year of the Dog. Brad's Status stars Ben Stiller as Brad, a husband and father taking his son to visit the colleges he's applied to, including Harvard and Tufts. The college trip gets Brad thinking about his college friends who have become much more successful than he has. He runs a nonprofit organization. They're wealthy and are big names in their fields. We get to know what Brad is thinking through a series of voiceovers, like this one from the beginning of the film. Brad is tossing and turning in bed, questioning choices he's made in life, and feeling like a failure compared to his old college friends.
So many friends from college have become successful. Nick Pascal was a big movie director in Hollywood, living this crazy, decadent life. Jason Hatfield had his own hedge fund. Obscenely rich. Owns three houses. A big philanthropist. Billy Wurstler sold his tech company at 40. He's already retired, living a life of leisure in Maui. Craig Fisher worked for the White House. He's written all these bestsellers, always on TV. It's stupid to compare lives, but when I do, I feel somehow I failed. And over time, these feelings get worse.
That's Ben Stiller in Mike White's new movie, Brad's Status. Mike White, welcome back to Fresh Air. I love the film. Why did you want to write about jealousy and always measuring your accomplishments against those of college friends who are more famous and more successful?
I felt like I was wanting to write about, status anxiety. And I find that I sometimes, lie at night, not necessarily in a jealous place, but I do feel like I have a relationship to my sense of where I stand in the world. I wished I had been more successful. I don't know. And I find when I'm in that kind of frame of mind, it's so embarrassing to talk about with other people. And because I find it like a side of myself that is so kind of just so not cool about it, that I was like, maybe there's something to unpack here.
And, in your life, like, you're successful, like, you've made movies,
you've had an
HBO series, and you could probably measure yourself against people who are far less successful than you, who you knew from school, and other people who have franchise films now and have made like a fortune several times over.
Yeah. It's funny because I gave the script to Ben Stiller, who's the star, and he is, if anyone's successful in our business as a contemporary of mine, he's a few years older, but, it's Ben Stiller. He's had a huge Hollywood career, and he was like, I so relate to this character.
You cast yourself in the role of one of Ben Stiller's friends who's become very successful in Hollywood as a director. His Malibu mansion is on the front page of Architectural Digest. And Stiller's character imagines this friend getting married, marrying the man he loved, because there just has been a wedding to which the Stiller character wasn't invited. And in this fantasy that he has of that wedding, like, each of these two men are like smearing wedding cake on the other's face. And it's so much like, it's like fun and funny and romantic all at the same time. And he's so jealous. Meanwhile, he's in a wonderful marriage himself.
Right. Well, I think comparative anxiety, and he says it in the movie, but it's definitely a waste of time and energy. But I think it's just something that happens in, you know, it's a universal situation, but I also think that now more than ever with social media and the way you can access people's lives through Googling each other or like getting on Instagram, that you're just kind of more aware of like the curated lives of your contemporaries. And I think that that creates this sense of anxiety or a sense of lack and feeling like, you know, is somebody's vacation better than mine? Or is someone having a better life than mine? And it is a high-end problem and absurd, but it is something that I think people contend with.
Do you follow people on social media and do that kind of comparative thing?
I try not to, but I do. I mean, it's hard. It's hard to avoid it. At one point I was on Instagram and I had, you know, followers and followed a lot of people and was active on it. And then I started hating people that I actually like in real life just because of the way that they were sort of like presenting themselves through Instagram. And then I was like, I don't want to feel this way about these people. And then I started realizing that, like, I was looking at my own kind of curated, whatever, Instagram page. And I was like, gosh, you know, I'm sure there's times where I'm on some, you know, nice vacation or doing something fun. And somebody's sitting in some, like, dark room who's a friend of mine is like, great. Yeah, thanks. You know, I really needed to see that. Like, and you just go, I don't know. I just became more self-conscious as I continued to participate. And then I just had to bolt.
So since your film is all about that kind of always measuring who's more successful than you are and how come you're not more successful, what did success mean to you growing up with your father, Mel White, who has been on our show a couple of times? And, you know, we've talked to him and we've talked to you about him. So your father was a best known, well, best unknown, we could say, as a ghostwriter for books by evangelical leaders like Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and Jimmy and Tammy Faye Baker. But while he helped boost their success, he remained an invisible figure as a ghostwriter. But he was also invisible in the sense that he was gay and closeted during that period. He later not only came out, he became an activist. He became a minister to LGBTQ congregations. He started a group called Soul Force that was an LGBTQ group. So anyways, growing up with his father who had to hide things about himself professionally and personally, what did success mean? When you looked at your father, did you see somebody very successful or somebody hidden and invisible?
Well, I definitely thought of him as a success and still do, as somebody who was endeavoring to find his authentic self and at much risk, personal and professional, ended up having to speak his truth, for lack of a better cliche. And so I think of him as a success as a person. I admire him so much. I think as far as his own perceptions of success and like the more like external barometers of success, I think, like Brad, he's somebody who devoted the last half of his life to nonprofits and activism. And you know, sometimes I think it's, for him, I've seen that it's, you know, as he's retiring now and he has the money that he's left with to retire, I think there's moments where he questions, like, what did it all amount to? And what do I have to show for my life? And, you know, you can be praised and people can say, oh, wow, that's really, you know, noble of you or whatever. But, you know, I think there are people that are his age that have a lot more in just in terms of material wealth and success in that sense. And, you know, different ways to think about success. And when he was retiring, it made me think about his own feelings, maybe that, I don't know, maybe he wished he had more things to show, you know, for his life or something like that. And I if you asked him, he probably would have a much more wise kind of response to this, but that was my perception. And it made me think about what is the value of a life and what is happiness as you look back on the life and what's important.
The frame of the film is that the Ben Stiller character is taking his son on a college tour because his son is a senior in high school and his son is a very good musician and composer, and all the people at his school say, like, you can get into Harvard, you could get into the top schools because you're that good. And so they're going on a tour of Harvard and Tufts, and they live in Sacramento, so this is, you know, it's a big trip to the East Coast. And why did you want to frame it on this like father-son college trip? You know, the wife and mother is home because she can't leave work. She has a government job and she can't leave to get away for this trip.
I grew up in Southern California and I went back east with my dad and looked at schools. I also went once with my mother too. And I just remember that period of time was the first time where I had this intense status anxiety, and that getting into colleges and being accepted was the first kind of referendum on, you know, what has led you to this point, like your value and like what that means as far as your future. And my parents went to an unaccredited Bible college and, you know, they were not up to date on the Fodor's list of what's the best college, or they didn't care really. They just wanted me to be happy. But I was at this preparatory school that was very competitive, and I just kind of lost the plot. It was like the first time in my life where I was just so spun out about, you know, if I get into this school, this means that, and, you know, like, and other people getting into other schools. And so I just, you know, as I was thinking about status and trying to find a location for this idea, it seemed like that might be the right time and place, you know, a kid who's about to apply to schools, and that his father, you know, I think for parents, it is also another time where, you know, it's a referendum on their parenting. And it just seemed like, even though I don't have kids, it just seemed like it was ripe for a lot of the ideas that I wanted to get at in the movie.
And Brad, the father, the Ben Stiller character, seems to in some ways not only be jealous of his old college friends, but to be jealous of his son, because his son is young and he's going to college and it's going to be an exciting experience. And his son is incredibly talented. His son has a gift. And have you seen that with people actually being jealous of their children?
Well, I think it's something that I was thinking about it in terms of my dad, and I think that my because my dad was enlightened in a certain sense, and he, in the progression of like where his parents were at versus like the kind of parent he was to me, he really allowed me to, I don't know, try to just become the person I wanted to be as opposed to put a lot of things on me. And so I haven't struggled in the certain ways that he had to struggle. And I think I know he is happy and proud of his role as a parent. And at the same time, I think sometimes I can see that because it was easier for me because I didn't have his parents. I think I do sense that there's probably a part of him who, I don't know, maybe is jealous of that reality for me. And not like something that is like he doesn't wish the best for me, but just that, you know, it's just a little bit of like, it's like, it was just easier for me because of him, you know? And I think.
You okay?
Yeah. No, I'm just, it's, yeah, I, for some reason, yeah, it's slightly emotional because I realize sorry. Is like the whole heart of the movie is just me telling my dad that I love him. And, yeah, and I'm grateful for him, and I see him as a success. Yeah. Anyway. Sorry. I think you just hit on like. To me, the movie is me. It's a love gift I'm trying to get at, in a sense, from my dad, is one way of looking at it. Sorry.
But I bet, unlike in the movie, that your father knows how you feel.
Yeah. Oh, he knows. And he's not as tortured as Brad. He's not Brad. It was just, you know, it's like you get at these little things and then you try to turn it into ideas and, you try to make it more universal or I don't know, specific in some other way. And so, at the core of it, it really is, getting at like, you know, I do think that life is a grassroots campaign, you know, where success is about you know, starting with yourself and then starting with the people that are the closest to you and building out from there, you know, like, and that if, you know, it's like, and I think that trying to find success from some kind of top-down campaign where it's like, oh, I won an Oscar, so that means I'm success, or, you know, I have fans and that means I'm a success, or I have all this wealth, that means I'm a success, or I'm the president of the United States and I, you know, like, I'm still tweeting late at night. Like, you just see that that's not going to, like, you know, like, that really you have to, yeah, it starts with you and you have to, yeah, build out from just, you know, the dirt and the ground that you stand on.
So when you went on a college tour with your father, was your relationship good enough at the time that you didn't have to, like, try to separate? You know how, like, some kids at that age are kind of embarrassed about their parents?
No,
and you go into college and you don't want to be judged on who your parents are. You want to be judged on who you are. So, you know, you want to separate yourself from your parents.
Right. Oh, no, I was at my worst. I was convinced that, like, anything that my dad's very social and genial and extroverted and would interact with everyone. And I was just, like, in my head being like, every bad encounter in my mind was going to be remembered forever. And, like, I was never gonna be able to go to this school. And I was like, and the character in the movie that is played by Austin Abrams is, like, a lot more wise and grounded than I was, but he, you know, I thought Austin, he was so, when he came in and auditioned, I was like, oh, wow, he just nails this certain kind of thing where I think kids at a certain age, right when they're about to leave the house, it's like everything their parents do is like nails on a chalkboard, but they don't really want to get into it because it just exacerbates the issue. So they just kind of like shut down and become kind of monosyllabic and just sort of like, it's like, you just sense that they're just trying to survive until they're free. And I just felt like that withholding thing he was doing, but without being petulant or being kind of, I don't know, like, I don't know, argumentative, was exactly the tone that I was like, that just felt so true to me. And he just brought that naturally.
So, Mike, this is your movie's a father-son story. And you don't have children. So if you don't mind my asking, I don't have children, and so I'm always interested in hearing people's stories about this. When you watch friends who do have children and you wonder how your life would have been different had you had children, and you could still have them at some time in the future, but you haven't yet. So when you look at your life, do you wonder how it would have been different for better or for worse?
I think I thought about that more, I think, in my 30s, but just about whether it was something I wanted, and also feeling like that was something everyone was doing, and I was like, am I missing out on something? And especially, I don't know, as a writer, you think about things as far as, like, or, I mean, and a writer meaning, like, as somebody who, it's like I want to get out of life with the most, I don't know, like, with the depth of life, I guess, and feeling like having not had kids, well, I feel like I've, missed out on some essential aspect to life. And I'm constantly told by friends who have kids that I am, but, you know, not in necessarily direct ways, but indirect ways. But I don't think about that as much anymore, and I don't want kids, but I certainly have a lot of kids in my life and enjoy them.
What kids do you have in your life?
Well, just friends' kids. I'm the godfather to a bunch of kids, two different kids. And I like being with children and young adults. And I enjoy that. And so I think there is a part of me that would have been a good father. And at the same time, I'm just so tired. No, I do think that, you know, an enlightened kind of got at some of these ideas with Laura's character, which is, you know, some of the, you know, I think they're, you know, not having kids, you can direct some of the energy that people do direct toward their kids, toward the public sphere, or different kinds of things that I think really are positive for society. And I don't know, I think that there's something great about not having kids, as well as you know, not, it's not just a selfish thing to be like, I don't want to, you know, like devote my life to caring for someone else. I think there's other things you can do with that energy, I guess.
Now, you also cast Jermaine Clement as one of the college friends who's very successful, or at least Stiller assumes that he is. He's a kind of tech entrepreneur who's sold the business and retired in Maui. In fact, why don't we hear a scene? And this is the kind of funny Ben Stiller from early in the film. So Ben Stiller needs the phone number of one of the college friends so that he can ask for some help for his son at Harvard. And so he calls the Jermaine Clement character. And for people who don't know Jermaine Clement, he was in the HBO series Flight of the Conchords. So here's the Ben Stiller character calling the Jermaine Clement character.
Do you happen to have Craig's number? I wanted to ask him something, but I think that he changed it.
Oh, yeah, I'll text it to you. I just saw him in L.A. at Nick's wedding.
Nick got married? To who?
To Javier. It was actually very cool. It was a beautiful ceremony.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, I didn't know about it.
Oh, well, it was real small. Somebody asked about you. I forget who. Mm-hmm.
They were, like, asking about,
you know, where you were or whatever happened to you or, I don't know, who was it?
Who was it? Someone was saying, where's Brad? I remember that guy, Brad.
Oh, well, I'm just been doing my thing.
Dude.
It's good to hear your voice. My dog took though, so I got to pick it up.
Okay.
And there's the ocean we heard in the background because he's walking by the ocean. So did you know Jermaine Clement from Flight of the Conchords?
I knew him. I knew his work from there. And we actually acted in a movie together, a little scene movie by the name of Gentleman Broncos. And so I got to know him kind of well in the shoot. And... yeah, he just seemed like he'd be a funny person to. I just know that, like, because of some of these smaller parts, you know, it's just really one side of a phone call and a few flashbacks and stuff. So I was just like, I need actors I know who can just kind of really create a presence in a really short period of time.
So the character they're referring to, who had the wedding that Ben Stiller's character was not invited to. You play that character who got married at that fabulous wedding. So you cast yourself in a small role as somebody who is very successful, who the Ben Stiller character is very envious of. It was interesting to see you cast yourself in such a successful role, somebody who's getting married to the man he loves, and it's a lovely wedding. And so how come you cast yourself in that role?
Well, there was a practical reason, which was that this character didn't really have any lines, but at the same time had to be in a couple different locations. We shot in Montreal and Boston and then Honolulu. And so it was like, okay, how are we going to get an extra? Like, we were on a limited budget. So there was a practical reason that I did it. In fact, the director of photography of the movie plays my husband in those scenes. So we were kind of like, well, we're flying ourselves there. We can save some money. But I also thought it was kind of a funny idea because, well, one, usually in the stuff I've played in my own things, I'm usually the kind of sad sack, like, I don't know, loser at the computer or whatever. And I thought that it would be, you know, just from a meta point of view that, you know, people might think I'm Brad. But, you know, like, that you can be on both sides of the same idea sometimes, that you can be the object of other people's envy while you're envying others. And I just thought it would be interesting to do that kind of meta thing, I guess.
There's a scene where Stiller's character imagines his son being very successful. And he imagines his son on Jimmy Kimmel's show. And his son is like telling funny stories and then starting to tell stories about how crazy his father is. Ben Stiller is just like lying in bed watching his son imagineering. This is all in his imagination, but he's lying in bed watching his son on TV talk about how crazy his father is, and it ends up being just like a horrifying experience for him. And I wonder where that comes from for you.
Well, you mean, has that happened? I was on Jimmy Kimmel and talking about just a funny story about my childhood and going to a religious summer camp where they would have rapture drills and and various things that like traumatized me, and it was played as just comic anecdote, you know. But I know that my dad the next day was like, you know, that makes me look like I, you know, sent you to some, you know. He was like kind of ruffled, I guess, by it, because I think he took it as like, you know, it made it sound like I had crazy parents that would allow, you know, me to be in a situation like that. And so, yeah, there was a sort of a moment from life that's drawn from, which is, you know, I did have a crazy upbringing because I was in a kind of conservative Christian world. But my dad, you know, straddled it in a very, you know, my parents weren't crazy. But yeah, I think my dad is a little bit prickly about all of that, because I think he was a great parent, but I was exposed to a lot of dogma and some weird stuff.
What is a rapture drill?
A rapture drill is when we would wake up in the morning and all the campers would get together and they would be like, rapture! And then you'd like raise your arms to the sky as if like it's like a fire drill, but it was a rapture drill. So like all the good Christians will get, you know, I don't know, beamed up to heaven, and all of the sinners would be left to fend in the apocalypse.
So in rapture drills, do you imagine yourself, do you always imagine yourself being lifted up to heaven or raised?
Oh, no, that was the whole problem with religious summer camp. Because I just, the thing about me, I was just never, I never had that moment where I was like, I got it. I didn't know, they would have these like former junkies come and speak to us and, you know, in front of a campfire and tell us how they found Jesus under a bridge and changed their life. And then they would tell us to go out into the dark and accept Jesus into our hearts. And then we would all be sent out into the night. And like, I would be like, what is going on? And like, I would go look for my friends. And then I'd be like, hey, you want to go hang out? And they'd be like, go away, I'm accepting Jesus into my heart. And I would be like, am I the seed of the devil? And like, I really felt like I was, I never really felt like I was going to get raptured, to answer your question, no.
So were those rapture drills like an existential crisis for you?
Yeah, no, it was like, I remember really being tortured. And I was like, I'd send letters home, like, get me out of here. Like, it was very, you know, it was cultish, but like on such a mass scale, it's like, it's beyond a cult.
Well, I always find it interesting that, you know, your father managed to stay a Christian and maintain his beliefs, even though he threw out a lot of the things that he thought were really negative and wrong, like mm-hmm. the prohibitions against being gay or lesbian, because he came out and he wasn't going to deal with that anymore. And he participated in churches that, you know, welcomed LGBTQ people and built the church around those people. So, you know, he didn't have to abandon his faith, even though he abandoned some principles that he was taught in the version of the faith that he was brought up with and that the people around him espoused. And you didn't throw out, I don't know if you still go to church or not, but you maintain some kind of, you know, spiritual force in your life through, you know, meditation and studying Buddhism and, you know, whatever you've built around that.
Well, it's definitely taken me, I mean, I'm now in my 40s, it's taken me a couple decades to realize how much I did get out of certain elements of this Christian upbringing. And I'm grateful for a lot of it. Certainly the stuff that I got from my parents. You know, my mom is involved in really a sort of civic-minded Christian church and does a lot of great things. And I admire her and her friends and her church. And my dad, he instilled in us values that I think, you know, are really positive. You know, he really believed in Jesus as someone who walked in solidarity with the poor and the outcasts of society. And he always, you know, it was the kind of do unto others as you would have unto you. And this feeling that Jesus could come back in any form. And even before he came out and became an activist, he was very much in solidarity with civil rights. And, you know, so there was a conservative part of it, but there was also a very kind of, I don't know, a very, something very enlightened too about it, a real spiritual side that really was inclusive and that I really still appreciate and I guess draw on in my life still.
What do you like about reality shows?
You know, I tend to find that even like the most kind of fabricated reality show sometimes can speak to human motivations and behavior better than like the most well-observed scripted show. And sometimes when I'm watching scripted shows, because I'm in the industry and I know all these people, a lot of them, I tend to like get hyper mental. And sometimes, you know, at the end of the day, you're just trying to like kind of unwind. It's like it's just easier for me. It's like kind of just like I tend to enjoy watching some of these reality shows. Not a lot, but some of them, just because I just feel like they're compelling to me in certain ways, and then they're also like it's just a kind of a more relaxing way of deprogramming my brain at the end of the day.
I'm wondering if the election of Donald Trump as president has affected your life as a writer or as a person in any way.
Well, I was really grateful that I had written that movie, Beatrice at Dinner, because right at the inauguration was when we premiered it at Sundance. And I think I think there's a time where you really feel like you want to be, as an artist, speaking to something relevant that's happening in the culture now. And, you know, sometimes, you know, it's like I was glad that I wasn't, you know, going and talking to the press about like Nacho Libre at the moment where he was elected, that I had this movie that really spoke to some of the issues that I think, you know, are facing the country. And so and that makes me more so now as I'm, you know, trying to think of what to write next, is that, you know, you want to feel like you're part of the conversation. You feel sometimes when your values are more vulnerable, it makes you want to dig deep and feel like, okay, there's really a role for the artist now, whether the other side will listen to it, I don't know, but it feels like it's worth trying to weigh in on these values for our country. And yeah.
What was your early movie life like?
Well, I was obsessed with movies when I was young. Now I can't seem to watch a single movie, but when I was younger, I really looked to movies to kind of, like, I guess, fill out my life education. You know, I did it with books too, but, you know, I felt like I was in a very homogenous culture. I felt like movies kind of made me realize there's other lives going on. There's other kind of philosophies people live by. There's other, you know, and I guess I was hungry for all that. And so, you know, I watched movies and I loved all kinds of movies. I was definitely a movie geek, I guess.
You said that you can't watch movies anymore. What do you mean?
I just find that, I mean, I do watch some of them, but I find that I, you know, there's so many things I would rather do with my time now. Like, it isn't, you know, there used to be a time where I really wanted to see anything that felt like people were saying were culturally relevant or whatever. It's like if I go into a movie theater and like 5 minutes in, I'm not into it. Like I feel like I'm like trapped and I was just like, I gotta get out of here. So it's like, it just, for some reason, I just find that it's like, I've seen enough, you know, I've spent enough of my life watching movies. I don't feel like I need to do that anymore.
I'm wondering if you think it's symptomatic that you're not that interested in movies now, and maybe movies
no
are losing their kind of stature in American
it's
consciousness.
Possible.
Yeah.
It's possible. I mean, I think television may be becoming more. I do think there's definitely a hunger for people to. I mean, certainly people are watching things as much as ever. I mean, binging things and watching things. And I mean, I don't think people have the ability to be bored anymore. They have to like constantly be feeding themselves entertainment. And I think that for me, it's like that part of it I find kind of. That's the part that I find I'm tortured about having this career, because I feel like there's so much going on in the world, and it's like, you know, the idea that everyone's at home binging on Netflix, do I want to really be, I don't know, like, I don't know, like, having, you know, I don't know, like adding to the, just the content like out there. But, you know, and so my hope is I, or like what I'd like to think of myself is like, I'm trying to make movies that ask people to go back into the world, you know, like engage in the world and not, you know, flee from the world, but like, you know, participate in it and in the world outside just entertainment. And whether I'm successful at that or not, or if that's valuable or not, I don't know. But that's something that I like to, I don't know, that's what I endeavor to do.
Well, Mike White, thanks so much for coming back on Fresh Air. I always love talking with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Terry. I love talking to you.
Mike White wrote and directed the new film Brad Status, starring Ben Stiller. It will have its world premiere this weekend at the Toronto Film Festival and will open in theaters September 15th.